Tonight we're going to be talking to the conductor David Hill, one of Britain's leading choral conductors and an organist himself. David conducts the BBC Singers and is musical director of the Bach Choir. And perhaps, like me, some of you have his extraordinarily haunting recording of Tallis' Spem in Allium Motet in your CD collection. He's a conductor who can make 16th century music cross the centuries and offer up its full beauty and inventiveness to modern audiences, while also being an accomplished conductor of 20th century works, particularly Benjamin Britten. And fittingly, David, you have an eclectic range of literary favourites to discuss with us today, spanning the centuries and forms. So I rather wondered, do you look for escape in your reading, or do you want to complement what you're working on musically?
A bit of both. In a sense, the music is important to me in terms of just reading around it, and so that takes a lot of time in the preparation of things. So it's spare time, really, the odd, you know, time when you're on a train or indeed on a holiday, when it's great to be able to pick up a book and have a really good read. So I really enjoyed doing this, but it made me really read for this event, but actually realising you find quality time to do it.
Absolutely. The purpose of these events makes us all think we must find more time to do it. Choral music is quite close to poetry in the sense that you've got poetic language built into both. Is that a particular attraction for you?
Yes. I mean, choral music doesn't mean anything unless it's to la la la. If some of it is. But, you know, you've got words which actually were the very reason why that composer was setting those words into the music they wished to create from the words. So in fact, I think this flow is so important to me as a musician who works, I mean, obviously with choral singers and orchestras, but particularly with the singers, you can actually talk to them about what you think the author may have meant. And it's very, you know, this is permeates our lives.
Well, let's have your first reading. You've chosen an extract from Vikram Seth's An Equal Music, a popular choice of classical musicians. But could you just introduce this extract briefly for us, and then David Bamber is going to read it.
Well, this is essentially a love story between two musicians, a violinist and a pianist, who worked and met each other in Vienna as students. And very suddenly, the relationship was stopped because he fell out with his violin teacher in Vienna, as one does with teachers from time to time. And she was completely heartbroken because he hadn't told her he was going to leave. And suddenly, in Oxford Street, not very far away from here, he sees her 10 years later on another bus. And from that point onwards, really tries to pursue her and rekindle a relationship. And it starts with Radio 3.
Perfect. David Bamber, over to you.
I put down the phone and lie in bed with my hands behind my head. I have not heard from Julia for 3 days. I get up and pad around the flat, putting up the blinds. I turn on Radio 3. For me, even with a rack full of CDs to choose from and in a city as rich in concerts as London, this is morning or evening, an almost instinctive reaction. Now it often brings me pleasure and surprise, but when I lived in Rochdale, it was my lifeline, virtually my only source of classical music. Once a year, the Halle Orchestra performed in Champness Hall. 3 or 4 times a year, Mrs. Formby would take me to a recital organised by the local music society or something special in Manchester. But that was the sum of my contact with professionally performed live music. My small radio, which plucked music from the public air, was everything to me. I would listen to it for hours in my room. As with the public library in Manchester, I don't see how I could have become a musician without it. In the lessening darkness, I look for Venus. Dawn is breaking. A horizontal upwelling of pink, with one almost vertical gash of a contrail, like Lucifer hurtling down the sky. I turn the kettle on and empty a vase full of thick twigs of holly, the berries by now almost black, into the rubbish. A Bach cantata is being performed. Wie schön leuchtet der Morgenstern. The words put me in mind of one of Julia's favourite comic poets. It is a tangled web that I am weaving. If I have survived 10 years of absence and vacant regret, why are 3 days so unbearable?
The novel is about a long relationship between two musicians with its twists and turns. Why do you feel connected to it? Is it the music or is it the love affairs?
Oh, both. I think the love affair is very real. It's obviously very passionate. They were young, but there was something very special there. And you can hear from that extract a real note of regret in his voice, that sense in which he's a depressed man. You know, he's seen a person he really loves, yet he can't have her. And that's 10 years past. She's married, actually. She's got a son now. And things have moved on in some respects, but he's trying to turn the clocks back. And I think that may be a moral in this, that, you know, seize it while you can, probably. But there we are. This is how he builds the story. Also around the very difficult relationships, if you like, that exist between musicians sometimes. I would call it a healthy tension and release, which is also part of what good music making is about. And the tension and release is really between the members of the Maggiore string quartet, of which he is second violinist. And you sense that through their rehearsals and through their performing, you get this sense of the difficulty of trying to relate to each other. So it's a fantastic piece of writing by Seyth, who understands, I think, very, very clearly what pressures musicians are under in their pursuit of art and making great music. What happens in the relationship becomes even more complex in a way, because he introduces another aspect to it, which is more tragic, is that she's going profoundly deaf whilst having to somehow exist with her music. And these things, you know, to a musician, going deaf is the worst possible thing. And we know we know from Beethoven's time, yes, how much that was difficult to deal with. So that was an added and really very difficult aspect of the whole relationship.
The main character was trained in Manchester, and there's a lot of places in the book that you used to haunt as a student at Chet's, the music college there yourself.
Indeed, absolutely, yes. I mean, he's from Rochdale. Not that I know Rochdale that well, but certainly he talks about the Henry Watson Music Library in Manchester and other places, and the cathedral in Manchester. Yes, the haunts that I used to know about when I was at school at Cheetham's all those years ago. So, yes.
And we won't ask you about your love affairs at Chet's.
The love affairs at Chet's, well, they did exist. Yes, they did exist, but in a slightly different way to this.
This time, Wordsworth and a poem that some of you may be familiar with, Daffodils, but also with a geographical location.
Yes, why daffodils? I mean, everyone knows it. Well, it's because I could call it Cumberland. I've always objected to Cumbria, to Cumberland, and was brought up in the north of Carlisle, and I was very lucky. I had a wonderful childhood, went to a great primary school where the headmaster had three passions. He said, now look, you have to understand, you've got to know about the Lake District, you've got to understand about Hadrian's Wall, and you must understand about William Wordsworth. Now, couple that with the fact that my grandparents were farming just a few miles away from, indeed, where Wordsworth wrote so much of his poetry, just on the edge of the Lake District. And we did genuinely, every other week, run around the fields and through the woods in the farm, and we saw these daffodils, and we actually realised what he was writing about. So, yes, very special memories for me.
I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft, when on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon the inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils.
David Hill, when you on your couch do lie in vacant or in pensive mood, if this ever happens to a musician as busy as you, when you reflect on that poem, it takes you back, as you said, to your childhood, but now you're listening to it as a mature adult.
Yes, and always with a sense of feeling that one day I'd like to get back to the north and to Cumbria and Cumberland, as I would like to call it. But in a way, knowing that it was part of a childhood and something that really was very special. I think it was particularly the farm and being there so much and running around those areas, as I said, where you really felt a freedom. And in those days, you know, we did have freedom. It was wonderful to be able to do that and just explore in our own way. And then my brother became a curate in Cockermouth, which is just around the corner from where Wordsworth was. And in one stage, he lived. And so that was a sense in which, you know, we really did share so much about what the man was.
He was the local lad made good.
Well, indeed.
And another one here. I mean, just tell me a bit about how you then moved from that background, which, as you say, is farming, but you clearly from early on had an interest in words and a poetic sense. And what took you towards music?
Partly, I think, my grandmother at the farm, she was a wonderful singer and a pianist, and she led all of us into music if we wanted to do that. And my elder brother, who has been a great influence on me, and music was around. And I suppose being a choir boy in a church choir, we had the shockingly bad choir that I sang in, but we did sing and we did have a go at it. And I think all those things have a big impression on you. You know, singing words, sometimes you stop to think about them and what they might mean.
Yes.
And so these are things that as you grow older, you respect much more.
For now, let's have another reading. This is from John Irving's novel, A Prayer for Owen Meany. Two time frames in this book and reflections on childhood and adulthood, but also strong religious themes, which I presume appeal to you as a conductor of religious music.
Well, indeed, and the character, Owen Meany, it's a central character of the book, where the bit we're about to hear is, in fact, at warfare with the new headmaster of the school. And Owen Meany is an incredibly charismatic and persuasive sort of character, and he's managed to persuade the football team to lift the Volkswagen Beetle belonging to a teacher in the school and to put it into the school main hall on the stage. And by the time we get to this hilarious extract, the headmaster and staff are already engaged in a futile attempt to remove the beetle from the stage. It's hilarious.
David Bamber is going to read us an extract from A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving.
Who can really piece together all the details of such a case? I mean, who can ever get straight what happened exactly? It was an emotional moment for the headmaster, and there was no overestimating the pain in his lower back. He had lifted the car all by himself. Whether his back muscles went into spasms while he was attempting to steer the VW downstairs, or whether he suffered the spasms after his spectacular accident, well, this is academic, isn't it? Suffice it to say, the students in the foyer fled from the wildly approaching little vehicle. No doubt the melted snow and ice were on the Beetle's tires, too, and marble, as everyone knows, is slippery. This way and that way, the dynamic little car hopped down the staircase. Great slabs of marble appeared to leap off the polished handrails of the stairway, the result of the Volkswagen's gouging out hunks of marble as it skidded from side to side. There's an old New Hampshire phrase that is meant to express extreme fragility and damage. Like a robin's egg rolling down the spout of a rain gutter. Thus did the headmaster descend the marble staircase from the great hall to the foyer of the main academy building. Except that he didn't quite arrive at his destination. The car flipped and landed on its roof and jammed itself sideways and upside down in the middle of the stairway. The doors could not be opened, nor could the headmaster be removed from the wreckage. Such spasms assailed his lower back that he could not contort himself into the necessary posture to make an exit from the car through the space where the windshield had been. Randy White, sitting upside down and holding fast to the steering wheel, cried out that there was a conspiracy of students and faculty who were clearly against him. He said numerous unprintable things about Dr. Dolder's fussy drinking habits, about all German manufactured cars, about what wimps were masquerading as able-bodied among the faculty and their wives, and he shouted and screamed that his back was killing him until his wife, Sam, could be brought to the scene, where she knelt on the chipped marble stairs and gave her upside-down husband what comfort she could. Professionals were summoned to extricate him from the destroyed Volkswagen. Later, long after morning meeting was over, they finally rescued the headmaster by removing the driver's side door of Dr. Dolder's poor car with a torch.
Thank you, David Bamber. David Hill, this is obviously a very comic scene, anarchic. There must be a schoolboy mischief streak in here that appeals to you.
Yes, actually.
We're lucky not to have a car up here, that's all.
It reminds me of something that happened at our school, at Cheetham's, where we had a very eccentric, and I'll come to him in a moment in some respects, but a teacher who really didn't, he didn't endear himself to any of us. And he'd had a lot of people may know this, a sunbeam rapier. And we thought we'd dress it up before he went off for his summer holidays. And so this reminded me of it. And I'm afraid when I first read this book, I roared with laughter. And if I had to put the book down, it's going to recover for a little while.
It's good to know the musical elites of the country do exactly what any other children and pupils would do.
Yeah, it was a good thing to do.
When you say you had a sort of mixed relationship with masters, I mean, that sort of pupil-teacher relationship, which I suppose one sort of imagines in music to be this giving and taking and perfectly seamless, I mean, how much of it was like that for you and how much is actually rather more difficult?
I think it was difficult because I think things have changed since I was at school. And teaching boys to sing in the last 30 years, I realised actually the way in which I was having to teach them was also changing, the relationship with them. And in a way that, this 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, there was this kind of difficult relationship between you and them, really. I think there was almost an adversarial quality about the way they would approach things and certainly about the way we looked at them as teachers, whereas I think now, dare I say, on the whole, I think it's much more collaborative between the student and between the teacher. Maybe it's a bit less fun, I don't know. But it seems to be that, that's how it used to be in my childhood. Mm-hmm. And we quite liked that. I think it gave it some, real edge to what we were doing.
The book, as well as being very funny, and you reminded me of how good John Irving is at these mixed modes, and is this undertone of has an undertone as well of faith and the role of death in life, inevitability, and rather big questions under the guise of a rollicking American novel.
Well, yes, indeed, and the whole book, as far as I was concerned, I was just reading it in the hope that I would get something from it, and my eldest daughter said to me, "This is a great book, Dad." I didn't realise it until I got some way into it did I feel the religious connotations and complexities. And you can see from the person who was writing it, his friend, that he viewed Owen Meany in a Christ-like way. Mm. This extraordinary person who, on the whole, didn't lose his temper with people, just sort of, could deal with most things, incredibly intelligent, articulate, just you know, able to bring people along, very charismatic. Well, all those things. And of course, eventually, and without spoiling the story for anyone, eventually a big price is paid by Owen Meany. And this sense of sacrifice equates to a lot of people to being the one that Jesus Christ made as on the cross. And so there is this development of the two ideas, I think, all of the time. I have to say unashamedly, I like the more lugubrious music. I'm a Requiem man, love them, but, you know, not exclusively. But I do think that some of the finest music has been created from that sense in which we have to go inside ourselves and actually understand why we're here. And, you know, we're not immortal. You know, there is a moment when things will finish. And I think composers have actually, I mean, they've been unbelievably inspired by that and produced some of the finest music as a result, whether it's, for me, 1605 and Victoria's Requiem, or whether it's Berlioz and his thundering drums, or Verdi, terrifyingly so, in Dies Irae, and so on. I think it's just produced some of the most extraordinary, violent, and exquisite music.
Well, I am afraid that that is where our time has run out. And so I would like to ask you to thank David Hill and David Bamber very much. And David Hill's Prom from the Angry Planet is on the 5th of August.
Anne McElvoy, who presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event. The producer was Allegra McIlroy. And a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Susie Klein, still to come tonight from the BBC Philharmonic and conductor laureate Gianandrea Nozeda, a performance of Mahler's most misunderstood symphony, the 7th. It has no programme, no extra musical idea driving it, there's no singer in this piece. This is the composer's most purely abstract work. But what it does have is the most extraordinary use of the orchestra, combining instruments and colours in a way that Mahler never had done before. For tonight's conductor, Gianandrea Nozeda, the 7th is a futuristic piece, pushing the boundaries of what an orchestra can do.
Mahler was very imaginative. He had a lot of visions. He tried to find new sounds. But he didn't have the live electronics. He didn't have the electronic music. If Mahler would have been living in the 50s, probably could have been one of the greatest Moderna, Nono, all these kind of Stockhausen, all these kind of men, very curious. He found the way to put, for instance, the cowbells in a symphony. He did already in the 6th symphony. He does again in the 7th. He put the mandolin and the guitar. I was wondering, why guitar and mandolin? Of course, it's an act music, but it's not written as a serenade, serenata. And serenata in Italy is something you go with a mandolin and a guitar just under the balcony where you try to seduce the lady. But this music doesn't sound this way, so it's a serenade, act music, and act music for what? But he uses the same instruments. So that's why it's always a rebus, an enigma, a mystery. And you have to go through imagining what he's aiming from. I don't know. Probably from the beginning, which is a sort of Trauer March, to arrive to this joyful finale, which doesn't sound completely joyful to me. It's like if I don't feel, I feel a little bit depressed, but I don't want to show it. So when I meet other people, I try to overact, just to show over-exaggerated, over-the-top happiness. I think the finale sounds a little bit like that. So it's more Mahler in the beginning of the symphony and the first act music, especially in the scherzo, which is just the center point of all the symphonies.
Gianandrea Nozeda here to conduct the players of the BBC Philharmonic in Mahler's 7th symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.